thanks so much for having us, you guys. So we're going to talk to each other, and then we're going to open it up and hopefully learn from you guys, too. You guys can ask us questions, and we might ask you some questions. So get ready. As Judy said, I think a lot of you guys know me from my column, and Rachel was just asking me before this began, have I always been, you know, a fearless communicator? It makes me laugh, like fearless communicator, like Superman or something. But if indeed I am a fearless communicator, and we'll talk about that, if that is the case, has that always been the case? And I was thinking about that for today, obviously. And I've been writing this column for so long that it feels like, yeah, that's always just been natural. I just put it all out there. But really, when I started thinking about it, that's not the case. It's, you know, there was a time when this felt very much anathema to me. It was really uncomfortable to reveal so much about myself in print. And the reason for that is the same reasons you might imagine. You know, things are embarrassing, or we aren't supposed to talk about this stuff, or I didn't want people to make fun of me, strangers in particular, I wanted people to like my work, and what if this was too out there and they didn't like it? And also, professionally, I was a journalist. I mean, I was a journalist. I was a reporter before I was a columnist, and we were taught not to put ourselves in the story and not to sensationalize. And here, suddenly, I'd taken this turn and was being asked, in addition to writing these very unbiased, you know, straight-laced, you know, news stories, and then also, can you go write that column talking about your vagina? And so it was like, you know, I sort of had this, like, duality thing, like, I'm not supposed to do that. And will people take me seriously? Are we going to get in trouble? All that stuff. But, you know, once you get used to it, then it comes easier and easier and easier. So, I just wanted to say that, yes, professionally, there have been times when I absolutely was very uncomfortable. And even after I got comfortable with it, there have been particular columns where I have revealed things about myself that I thought, this is going to make a really good column, and so I need to say this, or this needs to be said and no one else is saying it and I have a platform, therefore I need to do it. And I just hit send and was like sick to my stomach, like, I cannot believe I'm the person whose name is going to be associated with those words. I'm going to get hate mail. People are going to, you know, think this about me, think that about me. Considered calling the editors and saying, can you pull it? Can you pull it? Can you pull it? I've never done that though. And I'm so glad that I never have, because I would say 99% of the time that I feel that, I then get an amazing amount of feedback from readers saying, thank you so much, because it was brave, or I feel that exact same thing and never told anybody that, or God, I was hoping someone would say this, or, you know, that kind of stuff, which is exactly the reason that I went into writing. You know, that's what I want. That's the whole reason that we as communicators communicate, is so that we can connect with someone and that someone can say, yeah, I feel the same thing you're feeling, and we are more alike than we are different. That's why we do this. And so the first thing I want to do is just start off tonight saying that for me, that's the reason to be fearless, is because when I do it, it always pays off with people saying thank you, and I connected with you, and I feel better about myself or the world today. And so that is so powerful, right? Okay. So, but I want to ask Judy a question about, because you guys don't know as much about her, because she doesn't write about her vagina in public.
And you write about it in private.
I want to read that. So, Judy, I wanted to ask you, in what ways and situations are you a fearless communicator? First, tell everybody the ways that you are courageous in your communication.
Well, I haven't been writing about my vagina in public, but
Ever since I've been a kid, actually, I started teaching at UCLA in 1971. And I was like 25 years old, and everybody in my class, I taught the first class in the psychology of women at UCLA, and everybody in my class was a middle-aged woman, older than me by 20 years or so, except for this one guy who was sitting in the back, and he heckled the living daylights out of me. He was just miserable, and everybody was real irritated with him, as it turns out. I didn't know that. I was like starry-eyed. So excited to be talking about women in this context. And at one point, about 3 or 4 weeks into the class, he stood up and he yelled, "There's no place in the university for fascists, communists, and feminists." I'm just like, wow. And I thought I was going to cry, which was really scary, because the last thing on earth, I was so mad. The last thing on earth I wanted to do was cry. And so I just kind of gathered myself up and I said, "I'm going to take a break now. Everybody's going to leave the classroom. And when we come back in 10 minutes, you will not be here." And I don't know where it came from. It was like a demon coming out of my mouth. And I went in the bathroom and cried. So he went and complained to the dean, and the dean told him that he could hand out pamphlets in front of my class. So, wow. But while they were on the break, the middle-aged women in my class went into, and this is a fearless thing to say, right, went into the parking lot, and they said to him, "If you ever show up again, we really will cut your penis off." Star Sign thinks that might be illegal to say. But he never showed up again. I can't imagine why. And, you know, the first time you do it, the first time you do something that's so ballsy, the first time you do something that's so against your nature in a way, because certainly in 1971, at the age of 25, newly minted PhD, I had absolutely no role models. There was not one professor at UCLA in the psych department that was a woman. And I'd gone through my whole PhD learning as I went through. I never had a Me Too experience because I got chased, when I would get chased around the table, I developed strategies for dealing with that and getting out, you know? So from very early on, being the only woman in a lot of environments, I think, made me feel like I had to be courageous if I was going to say anything at all. I was once accused of being the reason why the chairman of my department died. because I was fearless enough to say, "I don't think that everybody needs to take experimental psychology for 3 quarters. If you're going to be a clinician, you don't need to run rats for 3 quarters. And they wanted more units in experimental psychology, of course. So when you start to get really excited about and devoted to your work and to the ideas in your work, it's much easier to do what they teach you in the Marines, which is put it in a box, set it aside, and act. And there's lots of fears and misgivings and also misunderstandings that happen when you write fearlessly. But I agree with Starshine, 90% of the people that you're writing to are going to be supportive. And the people that send you hate mail are miserable, but there's such a minority of the people that you're going to be interacting with. And I wouldn't even read it, although I've never actually gotten any hate mail. Because, you know, it's hard to get hate mail on a textbook. Thank you. And another reason why I think is that teaching about sexuality also in the 70s and 80s, when there's certain words that I didn't even know how to say them, because I'd never heard them out loud. And we, Starshine and I, were looking them up on the web the other night just to see if we were pronouncing them correctly now. Words like coitus. And apparently there's lots of ways you can pronounce those, and they're all correct because nobody knows how to pronounce them. Right. With the British, I was really good. And it's funny, too. The other thing is you get to understanding that the things that people are afraid of are ridiculous. Why would you be afraid to name the parts of your body or talk about somebody dying instead of passing on or being in a transition or those kinds of things? So I do think that it helps to brace yourself, I guess, and take a moment to decide if you're really going to do this or not. But I think in instances where you feel that the people you're talking to, some of the people in that audience at least, need to know this and keep that in mind. Before I went on for my first presentation on death and dying, actually, I was really nervous about it. Starshine was with me. There were a lot of people in the audience who were movers and shakers in the end-of-life community at Santa Barbara, and I really wanted to make a good impression. And one of the women in our office that was at the book signing walked up and said, well, whenever I get nervous, I think about how important what I'm saying is. And I think that can get you through a lot of fear, feeling that what you're saying is important, that it breaks the ice for a great conversation, and that you can just barrel through your fears. And the more you barrel through your fears, the more chances you take, the more times you try, the better you get at it, because you start to understand there's a lot of support for it. For a long time, I taught a group process class at University of Washington, and I could watch people in the groups over and over again. There would be no real learning going on. And then all of a sudden, somebody would say something that was so, in a way, mundane, like they might say, I hate this class. And then everybody would be like, I hate it too. How come you hate it? And it would break the whole thing up so that then real conversation started happening. And I think that taking those chances is so worthwhile, because the level of connection you can get when people are emotionally aroused is quite strong and important, and a real source of courage for other people as well. So that's my short answer, long answer.
I have another question. I was thinking about, we're all here as professional communicators, but you know, one of the places that I think that a lot of us have an easier time communicating courageously is personally, when we as women are advocating for someone that we love, right? Like I know the most timid women in the world who would have zero trouble saying, like, you pushed my son, you know, or my mom needs oxygen, or, like, you know, when we're taking care of someone that needs us, the fear sort of falls away, right? But when we are advocating for ourselves, sometimes it's harder. So I wanted to ask you, Judy, in terms of professionally, if you have any insight from a developmental psychology standpoint as to what we can do to sort of pull that skill over into our professional lives as well, in terms of advocating for ourselves or for whatever we need to say that we are not able to do in a professional setting sometimes, but comes very naturally personally. Does that make sense?
I think audience has a lot to do with it. Especially when you're in a setting with other professional people, or in a hospital with a doctor, or in any kind of professional situation like that, part of it is that we're used to listening to authority. So questioning authority in that way becomes very difficult. And I just had a big run in the last couple of weeks with somebody that has a lot of authority over me. And so you have to be careful. I think the skills for listening well will put you really farther along in that pursuit. So rather than thinking about what you need to say right that minute, be very careful listening to the other person so that you can paraphrase what they say back to them. Often it will sound really bad to them if they're doing something that's not the right thing to do. And secondly, once you've really listened to them and you it makes it much easier to say what you want. I don't know why that is, but there's some kind of connection that takes place. I was in the hospital a couple weeks ago, sitting with someone who was dying that really needed to be let go. And the doctor came and talked to me, and he was so upset. And I was able to listen to him really well, and then it was much easier to tell him what he needed to do for the woman who was unable to let her husband go, simply because he felt like I understood him, and that made him also feel like I might understand the situation. Now, where it's an emergency situation, you don't need any help. Like if you got to go screaming down the aisle and get, you know, morphine for somebody that's in terrible pain or air for your mother, you're going to be able to do that. And I think the way to bring it in is partly to calm yourself down by listening to what's going on and observing what's going on really well. And then find that little place where you can see that the situation needs this particular word or action or feeling tone, and you find the breaks for it, for getting in there, partly by listening.
So another piece of this is, that I find is interesting, is to what extent we are perhaps naturally, to what extent some people are maybe more naturally courageous in their communication, versus, and, you know, in self-expression, versus more timid in that. And is, you know, is this something that can be learned? I come from a family of, like, sort of balls out women who just sort of put it all out there and say what they feel, and like the truth shall set you free kind of thing. So, so it feels comfortable to me. As long as something is true, there's no shame in saying it. And in fact, there may be shame in not saying it. That's sort of my family's philosophy, for better or worse. And in writing it, so I translate that to the page. And so that's why you get TMI about my life, as Carolyn was intimating. But there's people who are raised in very different situations than that. We don't talk about certain things. We don't talk about politics. We don't talk about religion. We don't talk about money. And also, there's a gender thing to that, right? Like, girls don't challenge people, and, you know, you're polite, and you don't...
Nice.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, I'd like to know from you about your own personal experience, in terms of, were you always someone who was a fearless communicator, and how did your gender play into that? And I'm going to make this a three-parter. And is it something that can be learned, bringing your developmental psychology into it?
Oh, yeah, it's something that can be learned. My mother was the kind of person that would say to you, you don't feel like that. So there was no space.
Is that why you went into psychology?
Yeah, that's why I thought, I don't want to end up like my mother. Maybe I should become a psychologist. And she denied her own feelings. She denied everybody else's feelings. She denied the truth over and over again. And so maybe because it was so blatant to me, like, she left us for the weekend. She was mad at my dad. She walked out. She went someplace else. She left us. She came back, and she never mentioned it. And if you ask her if she did, she'd say, I didn't do anything like that. So perhaps because it was so blatant, I sort of took the opposite path. You know, I was rebellious, at least, about that. But I do think that you get so much reinforcement a lot of the time for saying the unsayable, because actually everybody's thinking about it. So the question, is he going to die? Is he going to die today? Is a taboo question when you're sitting with somebody that's dying. But once you say it, it loosens up the situation enormously so that people can talk about those things. So I think just by, you might have to start by forcing yourself, but there's a lot of change that goes on in adult life. People, I mean, the research shows, for example, that when people say, what do you think you'll be like in 10 years? Most people will say, oh, you know, I don't think I'll change that much. I'm pretty happy with myself. I'll be this way and that way. 10 years from then, if you ask them how much they've changed, they'd say, oh, I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. We change a lot as adults. And one of the mysteries of adult development to me is why do people change in adulthood? What brings them to change? And a lot of times it's a crisis. You know, you have someone die, you get a divorce, one of your kids is sick, and suddenly you have a lot more courage because you're in crisis, and then you bring that forward as a resilient person. You bring that forward, and you realize you had success next time, and you become braver, and you push the boundaries more. In my private blog, which you can all access on WordPress, just put in Judith Stevens Long, I wrote quite a long series of things when I had cancer 5 years ago. I'm a survivor. Thank you. And one of the things that drew me to Starshine was in that private blog, I wrote a lot about things like poop. Because you have to face that every time you go in when you have cancer, they ask you how your poop is. And you have to find ways to describe it. You have to look at it. And so you find that it gets easier the older you get too, because everything is so ridiculous. Life is so ridiculous, you know. If you can get a sense of humor and a little bit of perspective, which I think aging really does allow you to do. And you also learn with age, the research also suggests that you learn with age how to avoid getting into situations that are going to cause you a lot of personal injury, and how to either manage the situation so that it doesn't drop on you, or manage to stay away from the situation so you don't get caught in it in the first place. And I think you do a lot of stupid things as a kid that can come back to you in ways that are unfortunate and shut you down. But if you keep taking those chances, you're going to get reinforced enough that it's actually going to change you over time. And it definitely is something that can be learned. So what do you think you have learned about about being brave?
Well, it pays off, because people, like you say, people appreciate it. People appreciate there being someone who will say what they're thinking. And I'm happy to be that person again, because once you get over the hump, you're like, I've already said enough that I have, you know, I have a thick skin or whatever. But one thing that I think is interesting too is people ask me sometimes, are there things that you just won't write about? And there are just a couple. Yeah, there's not a lot, because I'm really desperate for topics. And if you have any, please see me after. I'm doing this so long. I think I've written about everything I care about, you know, multiple times by now. So reasons that you should be fearful, or not fearful, but you know what I mean, reasons that you should hold back, careful, and not just sort of throw it all out there and like we've been saying, reasons not to do that. There are legitimate reasons to not do that, right? In communication, certainly in professional situations, we all know, you know, when your job's at stake and when you want to hurt someone's feelings, those kinds of things. For me, with the column, it tends to stem around hurting the feelings of people who are close to me. So, and I will admit that I actually push that farther than I might, or than some people might. But I have a family that's very forgiving. They sort of understand, like, if you're going to be in my kind of circle, you're going to get in the column at some point, and you just have to deal with it. But you know, I have kids, and they go through this certain narrow window of age where they care about this stuff, and they don't want people talking about them or knowing about them or whatever. And I had full press on them. I had full control of everything that was said or read or known about them and their diapers and their circumcisions and whatever for a really long time. And then suddenly they wanted control of their brand, so to speak.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You're absolutely right. It's, and it, you have it too when your kids say, don't post my picture and tag me without asking my permission. And you're like, oh, that's a thing. You know, it's the same kind of thing where you have to be sensitive to people. So I had a cousin who died is what happened a couple weeks ago. She was my age. We were very close. And she died instantaneously of a hypertensive stroke. And I had to fly back. It was very traumatic, and the family was very upset. And then I came back, and all I could think about that whole week was funerals, because we'd been at this funeral, and it was like a whirlwind thing, and her daughter and I had to put this funeral together, and we had no idea what kind of funeral she'd want, because she was 46, and like we never talked about that stuff. And so I had to write a column, and sometimes I've gotten to where I think I have to write about whatever's consuming me, because if I try to write a column about something else, it turns out really bad because it's fake and everyone knows it's fake and there's no passion in it and it's just lame. So I thought, oh my gosh, I have to write about this funeral thing. How do I do this without, I hope the family, like I have to try to be sensitive, right? So those kinds of things where it's worthwhile to take a step back and be like, am I going to hurt someone's feelings? But I want to know from you and, what situations you have stopped yourself from communicating, whether it's around death and dying or other issues.
Yeah, I think there are certain things in death and dying. For example, in the whole book, I never used the word corpse. And when I was finished, I thought to myself, oh, that wasn't very courageous.
But you get into some things, too. I mean, you think, well, why would she say corpse? But there's entire chapters about how to deal with a dead body. So
right. And so I think certain words upset people unnecessarily. So if you're dealing with some really sensitive topic, like death and dying or sexuality, those are really sensitive topics, you try to use the words that most likely will communicate the idea to other people without shocking them. And corpse has a lot of shock value. So in my public presentations, I say it once I get comfortable with the audience, and then people don't react. Once they see me, they know me a little bit, they think I'm not a scary person, then I can say something like that. But there are certain words in all those arenas about body function, about sexuality, about death and dying, money, somebody Sharon mentioned earlier, where people don't ordinarily talk about them. So you talk about finances, and even the title of my book is a little bit of a cheat, because it's called Living Well, Dying Well, and there's one chapter on living well. and it is strewn throughout the book, tips on, how to handle Alzheimer's, or what to do if you think you're having a stroke and stuff like that. So there's stuff in there that's about taking care of yourself. But the main point is about dying, and you need to soften things sometimes a little bit just to get in. And once you get in, then you have a lot more opportunity to say what you're thinking. So on my website, which is called Dying with Wisdom, I think it's a lot looser and a lot more personal, and I have a lot more personal stories than I do in the book, because I figure once people know what I'm talking about and what the point is of what I'm trying to do, they're going to be more open to dealing with all the shocking things. I had a real struggle at some point, because I was writing a piece on washing and dressing the body, corpse. And it gave directions on what you should do. And I struggled for the longest time about how to say that it's very likely that a corpse, when a person dies, they release all the fluids from their body. So I must have changed that sentence 40 times trying to, excrement? No. I looked all over the web to see how other people were handling it, because you don't want somebody to slam the book shut because they saw the word excrement. And you know that that's a very I don't know, it's just a really ugly word somehow. And so sometimes when you have enough time, you can struggle with the words themselves. So the message is still the same, but the word is not quite as harsh or as clinical. Excrement sounds kind of clinical. So I finally decided on waste, body waste. And it seemed to cover the ground without being, you know, shocking. And I think most people actually know that. But to think that you're going to wash and dress a body, you've got to be prepared for that. You've got to have towels and pads and all kinds of things like that, and maybe even gloves.
Did you know that's a thing now? People, you can do that at home. Or something. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Home, yeah. Most people want to die at home. I don't know if that's true in this audience, but most people would prefer to die at home. College students, right, they'd really like to die at home with all their family around them. They have these fantasies about how they'll die. And so then you're dead. If you die at home, then you're dead, and your family has to do something with that. So there's a big dying at home movement, and I've written out all the directions if that's something that you want to do, and talked about, you know, funeral directors who will help you do that. And there's a wonderful EOL community, end of life community in Santa Barbara, that they will do anything for you. You know, that's very open about what you might want at a funeral, or whether you want to have the body at home, or whether you want to have it brought home from the hospital. All those kinds of things are possible. And they're very shocking to some people. I said to my husband, I would like to be at home when I die. He goes, what? I said, yeah, I think it would be nice if you washed me and dressed me when I was dead.
Did you tell him about the waste?
About the waste, yeah, right. I don't think he's up to it, but at least he knows what I want, so.
I have a question I'd like to ask the audience, actually. Let's do ask the audience.
I would like to know from you guys, how do you gauge the safety of an audience when you're trying to figure out what is safe to say? When you're trying to decide, can I say this fearlessly, or do I need to dial it back? How do you figure out your audience? And maybe it'd be easier to answer it in an anecdote, in an example of a time when you were having to say something and you were trying to decide and you had to base it on who you were talking to, as Judy had suggested, know your audience. Anybody?
I wasn't going to go first. I what comes up for me is, as a freelance writer, and I know there are a lot of writers out here, it's really interesting. Can I keep your job? Actually, it's easier.
They are. I think it's really interesting from stories I've written, the things that I was really worried people would be upset about. I wrote a piece for The Independent years ago called Confessions of a Serial Monogamist, and it was just sort of satirical about, you know, being the reverse, you know, being sort of like a guy, not wanting to commit. And I thought people would be super upset, and they weren't. It was all positive. And then during my travel writing, I wrote a piece on New Zealand and how much I love New Zealand, and I had the most angry, hateful email from someone about how horrible New Zealanders are. And then I had backlash on this article I wrote that was like a love letter to Croatia. And I was shocked that someone misconstrued the article and thought I was coming down on Croatians. And so as a writer, like, it's interesting, because if I care too much, worrying too much about offending people, it dilutes what I'm writing. And I feel like I've gotten into this thing where so much social media, it feels like you're diluting your message, and it's rainbows and unicorns, and it's taking me away from that, like, bold writer. So I don't know how to figure out the audience, and I think in a way, like, it's good to not overthink it. Otherwise, you're worrying about things that may never happen, and you can never guess what people are going to be. People are going to eventually be really pissed off if you write enough.
So.
There's an article I read by Stephen King, actually, who says most bad writing is caused by fear.
He's the one who makes us afraid.
Yeah, I know. I know, that's interesting. But you can't,
you can't stew over something a long time because there's no way that you are going to figure out what is perfect for somebody else. When you get it to be perfect for you, there's definitely going to be somebody out there that it's not perfect for. So if you worry about trying to please everyone, which we do as women a lot, worry about trying to please everyone, you're never going to say anything really, really passionate, really important, really mind-boggling or a breakthrough. So being I had a student that was writing about downsizing, institutional downsizing, and I said, well, you mean they fired people? And she said, yeah, but you can't really use that word. And I was like, yes, you can. You actually can use that word, and it will attract more attention. So part of being courageous is to get a hook out there that will attract people's attention, and then you take that chance to get that attention. Starshine is a real attention monger here. She knows how to get somebody's attention really well. And your work will reach a larger audience if you are brave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I recently went to a talk on stress by Dr. Winner. Was anyone at that talk? It was really interesting. And he was saying how, and we all know this, how stress feels the same as excitement. There's a similar thing that happens in the body where when you're really excited about something and you're kind of stressed about something, you have a similar. So if you're just sort of stressed about something, you can tell yourself, no, I'm just really excited. That's kind of funny. I've been trying that. Like, I'm excited about this tax return. But similarly, you know, you can kind of feel that way about when you have something to express that you are uncomfortable with too. I mean, if we think back to like some of the stressful, exciting times in our lives that, that we weren't excited about, but that we were nervous about, like your first job interview or, you know, being dropped off at college or, you know, a first date or something like that. I mean, that was probably more pleasant, but you know, just those feelings that you wouldn't trade them for anything. I mean, that excitement and what you and how you grow from that and how you sort of became a new person after that, like you conquered something. That's the kind of feeling you can have when you put yourself out on a limb and try it and try and say something that makes you uncomfortable and nervous. So anyway, I want to know if anyone else has questions for us. Let's open it up to the audience. Does anybody have questions for us?
By the way, my granddaughter calls that nervous-sided.
Nervous-sided.
Really nervous-sided then. Yeah, we'll take questions on anything. Communication, death, vaginas, whatever you have.
Oh, I can talk really loud for a short person, but okay.
Even louder.
So it was just a few years ago that I read / listened to Amy Cuddy's book, Presence. I don't know if anyone's heard it, but that was when I discovered the idea of imposter syndrome and had no idea what it was before and just thought I really was this fake person that somebody was going to figure out someday. So it was wonderful to realize that this is just this internal fear that many of us have that nobody talks about. But it wasn't until after really understanding that and learning how to be myself that I became more of a fearless communicator. So I'm just curious if either of you have had any experience with imposter syndrome and if that had anything to do with your passion for fearless communication.
I don't know what that is.
Does anybody feel very, very qualified to talk about that? Because you feel you walk around and like something like 88% of women have this and just don't talk about it. But we walk around feeling one day they're going to figure out that I don't really know what I'm doing. And you never feel like you ever actually accomplish anything. So you're constantly trying to do more and more to feel like you're worthy of where your position because you just never feel like you deserve it. And it holds you back so much because you feel like if I talk, they're going to realize I don't know what I'm saying or I don't know what I'm doing because you just don't have this confidence because you feel so unnecessarily, you know, fake. But once I realized that, it was literally within a couple of days, I realized this is not fake. You know, I'm not fake. There's nothing. So anyway, I could talk about that forever.
What's the percentage of women who have that?
Something 80-something percent of women.
Did they say what the percentage of men is?
They didn't talk about men.
But I have read that it's an equal number of men and women that
I've
suffer
heard that
from
more
imposter
recently.
Syndrome. I think it was more women, but it's equal.
Am I human?
Somewhat equal.
Right. Can you imagine suddenly becoming, there's a very funny old cartoon where this woman is standing up there and a guy standing behind her and he has a crown and she has groceries. It says, Cynthia is unexpectedly crowned queen of Sweden. And if you can imagine suddenly coming into a position like that that you know nothing about, that's how you feel if you have imposter syndrome, even though you do have the ability and the knowledge and the qualifications. You feel like you're not, you don't know what you're doing, or somebody's going to find out that you don't know what you're doing. And as an introvert, especially, and a feeling person too, I make most of my decisions based on my gut. I found that I had to develop an act, which is like almost the opposite of imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. an extroverted thinking kind of act to be accepted as a college professor in certain circumstances. So there are persona, right, that you have that you present to the public, for example, and that's something you can actually develop that can take the place of that. If you figure out what the imposter syndrome is about, and you think, oh, I can be more out there myself because I actually do have the qualifications and stuff. Does anybody think they have imposter syndrome? It's a very common thing. I think you just, when you work on trying to bring those two things together, those two personas together, make a lot of difference.
I'm just curious, I'm throwing it out there, as a woman, how much of imposter syndrome might develop in response to being ignored by men who look at you and are like, okay, that's nice, what does the guy have to say? This is something I feel like I encounter in some professional situations that I don't need to go into, but it's like, if I say something, nobody ever heard it. If a man comes in as an expert and says it, we're going to change what we're doing and shift course, and that's what we're going to do now because this expert came in and shared his knowledge with us. So yeah. I'm wondering, how much of imposter syndrome might be not just we're bringing this insecurity or non-confidence with us, or is it how much of it is like, wait, I had this confidence, and then it fell on deaf ears for so long that
it's also
I start to question.
There also has to be something in your history. So I think a lot of times when you're making a response that seems irrational, right, that you look at...
There's this wonderful technique in developmental psychology that is used a lot for understanding the kind of roots of something. And you think about the first time you felt that way. The first time you felt like an imposter, or the first time you felt like somebody wasn't paying any attention to you because you were a girl, woman, teenager, whatever, and you play that back in your mind in as much detail as you can, and then you bring yourself as a third person to the situation, watching it and thinking what was going on there, and how do I bring that forward? How does that play out in my present life? And sometimes when you do that for yourself, it makes a huge difference when you get in the situation. You think, oh, this is old business. This is something I thought about myself forever, and it's not helpful. So I'm going to state again, hey, Henry, thanks for that. I really appreciate the fact that you put my idea like that. It's perfect. You know, irony helps.
Is there anything that in our current president's speaking style that we can learn about fearless communication? I say that because we all know the problems and errors in his communication, but we have to admit that he's been effective for a certain population. And I just want to know if there is anything positive or lessons.
Backward, forward, and inside out. And one of the ways I can defend my work a lot of times is to be able to say, this is written, I know who I'm writing this to. I am writing this to a middle-aged woman who has maybe an AA degree or good high school, went to a good high school, who is interested in self-help, who reads a lot of self-help books, and she's got parents who are getting sick, and she needs my help. So I feel more free to talk to her in an intimate way if I have her right in my mind. And my sister is my audience in this case. My sister is that person. And I think, you know, he is speaking to a person he knows who is in that category, and he talks constantly to that person. It really helps one to be fearless, to know who you're talking to.
You know, in some ways, he really is a great model for this, right? Because he's someone who doesn't care what anyone else thinks. I mean, for better or worse, obviously. But, you know, he's predictable. So there's that. Now he's predictable, but at the beginning, he made a point of just being outrageous. He was just trying to be outrageous. He would just say whatever he could to just push buttons, which, you know, I'm guilty of that a little bit too, so I can't dig too deep there. But I would say, gosh, what a good question. I think Judy's right. He knows. I know your audience. I'm going to stick with that before I get in any trouble.
Also, he speaks in simple Anglo-Saxon. And simple Anglo-Saxon is motivating to people. So here's something. Just do it. I had a dream. Those are very short, simple sentences. It's much better than saying a dream was had by me. You know? So I think the fact that he's direct, that he speaks in the present tense all the time, that he uses short sentences. He also uses quite a lot of emotional words, sad, great, fabulous. You know, he uses a lot of words that evoke or refer to emotion. And I think having passion in your work, speaking directly, using short sentences, never go over 25 words. 25 words or less is my motto. You really start and stay in the present tense. Mm-hmm. It's very motivating for people. It's very present to people. And he's very present. I mean, you cannot avoid the man. And so be present, be direct, be simple, and call on an emotion, tell a story, bring it to a personal level. Those are all ways that can really help you, I think, dig into getting connected with your audience.
This actually raises an interesting question for me, though. I mean, part of the reason, as you said, that he has such an effect is that he doesn't give a damn what people are going to think. And women often find that that's, you know, that you do give a damn. And so I thought it was interesting, the story that you told about, you know, having this confrontation and then going to the women's room and weeping, because I feel like I might be capable of the moment of, you know, being strong, but it will have an impact on me. And it may make it hard for me for days. I may never write about the subject again, you know, so one of the things that I'm interested, And it seems to me that the model of our leader is not where I want to go. I don't want to be oblivious to the input from other people, you know, and I don't want to run roughshod over what is happening for other people when I communicate with them. On the other hand, I don't want to be at the mercy of that. And I find that, you know, I don't know about the rest of you, but I ruminate. You know, I mean, they can write me one mean letter. I don't know how you do it with, you know, because, I mean, I know you don't get trolls anymore because they stopped.
Oh. I don't know, they turned off the comments at the Independent is what she's talking about. But I get emails. So I don't ruminate anymore, but I certainly did for many years, and I mean, I really get some nasty, nasty stuff sent to me, and it really hurt my feelings for a while. But you know, you get more good than bad, so you keep going, and then people are like, keep going, we love this. And it's like, okay, but I'm taking it on the chin every week, and it really hurts my feelings. And then you start to kind of get a thick skin. I grew up in the entertainment industry. My family's all, I literally grew up in Hollywood, and my family's all in the entertainment business. So they all have thick skins, and so I was brought up that way, and you're just supposed to let it roll off your back. So I got okay at that. But there, every once in a while, someone will still send me an email that gets under my skin, and the reason it does is only if they're right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the reason I read comments. I read comments to find out if I missed anything. Because, I mean, I teach column writing, and I teach crafting an argument. And it's like I've been doing this so long. It's this one thing I'm really good at is, like, making an argument in 600 words. You know, boom, get in, get out. And I tell my students, you know, you have to shore it up, and you have to show the other side, and you have to do this, and you have to get it done by the third paragraph. Otherwise, you're going to lose people, and you have to do this, and you have to come around at the end with a kicker that ties back into the beginning so that people feel like they're on this journey, and it's like this whole thing. And if I miss anything in there, I get so angry with myself. And so I would read the comments to see if someone said, you know what, she didn't even mention this other thing that is so important to this topic. I was dismissed. If someone can summarily dismiss you, right, then suddenly it's like, ah, the whole thing was for naught. And so to this day, if someone sends me an email with a really good rebuttal that I didn't figure into my argument, I ruminate. That'll get me. Yeah.
I also think that it's hardest when somebody's right, but a lot of times if you can put it aside for a little while, somebody gives you feedback that makes you upset, and you can actually just kind of put it in the drawer and not think about it for a little while, over a couple of days, you'll usually be able to see what it was that was the hook for you and address that. So people come at me a lot of times because they don't have the background. They just don't have the background. And they're coming from an ignorant place about it. And if I can understand that, if I can find some compassion in myself for a person who has to express themselves that way, that helps a lot. And the other thing is I've learned to do is take note of how long it takes me to get over something. So I know now pretty well it's going to take me 24 hours to get over this. It's going to take me 2 days to get over this. And being able to just know yourself well enough to know how long it's going to take you to get over it and when you're going to be able to address it also helps greatly. So I think also the more you know your own hooks and the more you know how your own mind and your own emotions work, then the easier it is to predict and find strategies for dealing with it inside yourself. And if somebody writes you something, you know, really ugly, you can always try my mother's strategy. Say, you don't really feel like that.
Fortunate to get to work with both of you, but you know, particularly tonight, you make me feel even more fortunate.
Her husband said she doesn't need any encouragement.
Our fearless photographer has asked that we all take a group picture in our new location.
Yeah.
So maybe we can just pull you forward and we can group ourselves around you and have a photograph. Okay? And I think, yes, I think.